Good morning. It's good to be here with you. Doesn't it seem like Christmas was like 6 months ago? Christmas Eve around here is a pretty big deal, and I usually have a lot of responsibilities on Christmas Eve. It's kind of like the Super Bowl of my job. And so this year, all of my kids were in town, my oldest daughter and her husband and their 85-pound chocolate lab puppy were at my house. And then my middle daughter came from Tennessee, and my youngest daughter was home from college, and so they all decided that they would come to the Saturday night Christmas Eve service together. But Brittany got sick, the middle one, and so she stayed home. And usually during the service, I have my phone with me because Caleb, our AV guy, we're communicating via text if there's something that we need to solve or some issue or whatever. And all of a sudden, my phone just starts like blowing up with texts. So I open it, and it's our family group text, and I can't read it all. So I just scroll to the very last one to get the gist, and this is what Brittany has sent. Guys, help. Should I call the fire department? And I'm like, oh, for the love. Like, what am I supposed to do? You know, I'm supposed to be on stage in 2 seconds. So, you know, I just have to trust and let it go. So as soon as I can, I sneak into the prayer room and call Brittany. Okay, sweetie, what is going on? Are you okay? And she's like, Mom, Nixon, the 85-pound chocolate lab puppy, chased a cat up to the top of the telephone pole in the backyard, and I don't know what to do. Should I call the fire department? And I'm like, I'll call you later. So I hang up the phone, I go back, finish my job here, you know, and then get home, and we walk in the house, and she is literally just like frazzled. You have to help me save this cat. I don't know what to do. I've tried everything. I go, well, what does tried everything mean? She goes, well, I pulled a ladder out of the garage and put it up against the pole, but it was too short. I'm like, yes, it's a 6-foot homeowner's ladder against a 40-foot telephone pole. And she's like, I know. So then I went and got a broom and climbed up on the ladder and was hoping maybe the kitty would jump on the broom. And that didn't work. So then I pulled the picnic table from the entire other side of the yard over to the telephone pole and put the ladder on top of it, climbed up on it with the broom, and I just couldn't get the kitty down. So I go outside to see all the elements of rescue. And I go, Britt, what's the hammock doing there? And then I look, and it looks like every blanket I own is stacked on the other side of the telephone pole. And I go, what's the deal with the hammock and the blankets? And she goes, well, since I couldn't get the cat down, I thought if it fell, I would try to just ease its fall. And I was like, how much NyQuil have you taken? Brittany's allergic to cats. She was sick. She had a fever. It was Christmas. It was nighttime. It was cold. It was in the dark. And she was intent on rescue because there was a mandate of mercy in her heart. And so she was on a mission. We're in a series in Luke season 2. And today, we're going to talk about the mandate and the mission of mercy. Our story is in Luke chapter 10, and it is probably the most well-known parable that Jesus ever told. It's the parable of the Good Samaritan. And out of that parable, we have things like Good Samaritan laws. We have RVs and their special rules, which are called Good Sammies. We have Good Samaritan hospitals. TV episodes like on NCIS and Grey's Anatomy and Marvel's Agent of S.H.I.E.L.D., they all have episodes called The Good Samaritan. It's a very well-known story. And much of the lessons in it are accessible, whether you're a Christian or a believer or a churchgoer or not, because it compels you to do good and be kind. And while that is an important takeaway from this story, what Jesus is trying to teach us is so much deeper than just that. And the parable of the Good Samaritan actually starts by someone asking two questions. And so I want us to look at that. I want us to start prior to the parable, Luke chapter 10, verse 25. And I have a little bit of that junk going on, so give me just a second. All right, Luke 10, 25. And behold, a lawyer stood up to put him, Jesus, to the test, saying, Teacher, what shall I do to inherit eternal life? And Jesus said to him, what is written in the law? How do you read it? And the lawyer answered, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your strength, with all your mind, and your neighbor as yourself. And Jesus said to him, you have answered correctly. Do this, and you will live. And desiring to justify himself, he said to Jesus, and who is my neighbor? We have to understand the context and the meaning here in order to get the full picture. Remember, everything after chapter 9 in the book of Luke has Jesus going to the cross as its backdrop. And then we have to understand the particular context of this situation. So if you were here last week, you remember that Dave was teaching on that Jesus started with 12 disciples, and last week he commissioned the 72. 72 regular, common folk people, not from the rabbinic tradition, not educated, not of the priestly line, just 72 people who followed, who believed that he commissioned to go bring the good news of the Messiah, to heal, to cast out demons. And he told them to rejoice because their names were written in the book of life. And somewhere near this group of 72 was an expert in the law. The Bible calls him a lawyer. And he heard Jesus just tell all these common folk that their names were written in the book of life. And so he starts a conversation with Jesus. But he does it with the motives, not a sincere heart. He does it trying to get Jesus to say something that would go against the law and therefore discredit him. And then he also does it with the intention of trying to justify himself. He asks two questions. The first is, what can I do to inherit eternal life? The premise of this lawyer's belief was that you had to be really good and keep a lot of God's law, live piously, and then God might accept you. And for him, he looked around that group of 72 and said, I'm much more righteous and pious than they are. But Jesus, knowing what was in his heart, turned the question back on him. Look at verse 26. And he said to him, what is written in the law? How do you read it? So Jesus turns it back around. It's like a perfect therapist move. You know, when I was a therapist and working with clients, they would say, like, did they teach you in school how to answer a question with a question? Now I can just say I learned it from Jesus. That's what I did. Because, you know, the guy asked him a question and Jesus says, well, tell me what you understand. And the lawyer answers by summarizing the law, and he says this, love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind, and with all your strength. And love your neighbor as yourself. To love God with everything, to make him your number one priority so that perfect love guides your life. Perfect love guides your thoughts, your activities, your passions, your body, your time, your finances, your relationships. Perfect, complete love of God and others. That's his answer. And Jesus says to him, yep, good answer. Do that and you're golden. It's kind of like when I'm watching football. I'm kind of a big football fan, but I'm the most uncoordinated person in the entire world. So I'm watching football, but I feel free to coach from the couch. And typically, now I'm watching football with my friend Greg, who actually played college football. And so I'm saying things like, why in the world are you choosing that play on third down? You haven't been successful with that play the whole game. You got to convert it a third down or you're never going to win this game. And he's like, yeah, why don't you tell? Have you ever thought about coaching? You know, he's saying to me, like, it's a lot harder than you think, Heidi. Like, yeah, you can call it here from the couch, but it takes a lot more than that. And that's what Jesus is saying to this lawyer. Why don't you try to live in to what it is that you think you know? So this man, this expert, knowing he doesn't keep the law perfectly, knowing he's just been outed in front of these people, tries to justify himself. And he does so by saying, all right then, who exactly is my neighbor? Who am I commanded to love? Who's on the list that I have to do good to? What are the minimum requirements in order for me to fulfill the law? And it's in response to these two questions. What can I do to inherit eternal life? And who do I have to love? That Jesus tells the story of the Good Samaritan. Let's read it together. Sorry, I know that's so irritating, I can't help it. Let's go to verse 30. Jesus replied, "A man was going down from Jerusalem to Jericho, and he fell among robbers who stripped him and beat him and departed, leaving him half dead. Now by chance, a priest was going down that road, and when he saw him, he passed by on the other side. So likewise, a Levite, when he came to the place and saw him, passed by on the other side. But a Samaritan, as he journeyed, came to where he was, and when he saw him, he had compassion. He went to him and bound up his wounds, pouring on oil and wine. Then he set him on his own animal and brought him to an inn and took care of him. And the next day, he took out 2 denarii and gave them to the innkeeper, saying, 'Take care of him, and whatever you spend, I will repay you when I come back.'" "Which of these 3 do you think proved to be a neighbor to the man who fell among the robbers?" he said. "The one who showed him mercy." And Jesus said to him, "Go and do likewise." Now remember, the Good Samaritan is not an actual story, it's an anecdote. And everything is in there intentionally for a very specific purpose. The hero of the story is an enemy of all the people listening. The person in need in the story is a Jew, just like all the people who are listening. The setting is dangerous. It's a treacherous road. The situation is messy and unpredictable. And the essence is mercy. So many things that we could learn from this story, and I hope that you'll read it for yourself. But I'm just going to highlight a few of them for us. The first thing that I see there is that love your neighbor is not different than love your enemy. Those are not 2 different categories. For Jesus, it's not love your neighbor and then, you know, occasionally you got to love your enemy. For Jesus, it's love your neighbor, which includes your enemy, your acquaintances, strangers, people you know, people you don't know, people who are like you, people who are different than you. It's really just love. Like we sang, there are no boundaries to your love. Right? The Jews and the Samaritans, they were bitter enemies. And that's why it's so significant that the hero of the story is a Samaritan. Jews and Samaritans believed each other to be heretical and deserving of God's judgment. They despised each other. If you're a Lord of the Rings fan, it's like the dwarves and the elves. Harry Potter, it's like the Malfoys and the Muggles. In Romeo and Juliet, it's the Montagues and the Capulets. Today, it's Republicans and Democrats. Sadly. This passage, it takes a strong stand against racism, but not just racism. It takes a strong stand against prejudice of any form. Because the Jews and the Samaritans, you see, they didn't hate each other simply because of race. They actually shared DNA. They hated each other because their basic premise of life, their belief system, their worldview stood in opposition to one another. And therefore, they despised each other. So Jesus is telling this story to a group of Jews in response to a man who believes himself to be devout, who's committed to self-justification. And he makes the hero their enemy. Why? Because Jesus knows in self-justifying hearts, prejudice lives. So my friends, that means we gotta look inside. We gotta look inside and we gotta find any remnants of prejudice that lives in us. And it may not be as blatant as race or political party. It might be more subtle, like age or socioeconomic status. Maybe you have prejudice against rich people. Maybe you have prejudice against poor people. Maybe it's beauty. Maybe it's disability. Maybe it's culture. But we have to look inside and see what prejudice might live in us and ask Jesus to free us from that. So in this story, Jesus not only makes the hero their enemy, but he makes the bloody, broken, half-dead person just like them. Do you see what he's trying to do? He's trying to bring them to a place of their own need. He's not telling this story, calling them to be good. He's calling them to mercy. And mercy always begins with understanding the desperation of our own need. And that our own need is costly. You see, the ministry of mercy, it's going to cost us. The Samaritan, if you'll recall in verse 33, it'll come up on... He had compassion on him. He had to pour oil and wine on him. He bound up his wounds. He put him on his own animal. He took him to an inn. He paid for him. He stayed there. He took care of him. It cost him. The Samaritan had every reason to pass this bloody mess of a man by. I mean, the Levite did. The priest did. They all had somewhere they had to be. But the ministry of mercy, my friends, it takes time. And if we're too busy and too overwhelmed and too stressed out and too tapped out financially, emotionally, or spiritually, we will easily find ourselves moving to the other side of the road and walking by the needs that are right in front of us. For me, several years ago, when a tragedy hit my life and my husband died suddenly, I had a particular friend who just understood the ministry of mercy. And she stepped into my life in such tangible, helpful, beautiful ways in that whole first year. What I didn't know until later was that in the first couple weeks after my husband died, she rearranged her whole life. She rearranged her work schedule. She made a commitment to say no to any extra sorts of speaking engagements or work commitments. She arranged things in her family, all so that she could enter the mess of my life and engage in the ministry of mercy. She created margin for mercy so that she could rescue me. That's what it costs. That's the ministry of mercy. And it made a huge difference for us. It's also costly because this Jericho road, it was a dangerous place. It was perilous. Those people, they weren't on this road, those three characters, they weren't going on vacation. You only went on the Jericho road to get somewhere that only that road could get you to. Otherwise, you avoided it as much as you could. And so there was danger. Jesus chose this road specifically because he knows it's safer not to engage in the mess and problems that other people have. But the mandate of mercy begs us to enter it. Jeremy Courtney, he's the founder of an organization called Preemptive Love Coalition. And several years back, he and his wife just felt called, so they picked up, they moved with their two young children to the Middle East, one of the most volatile places on the entire planet. And their mission is mercy. They provide life-saving medical intervention. They provide food and aid. They're rescuing people, getting people out of terrible situations. And I heard him this week, and he said this: we do it scared every single day. Eradicating fear before I act, well, that's just unrealistic. There are reasons to be afraid. But I had to learn how to move fear out of the driver's seat and into the passenger seat. It's time, he says, that we reach across enemy lines and choose love over fear. And that's what the Samaritan did. He chose love over fear. See, Jesus isn't calling us to be foolish, but he's calling us to be fearing less. Right? Now, we have to ask ourselves at this point, why did Jesus choose a priest and a Levite to be the counterpart to the Samaritan? Why not a Pharisee and a fisherman? Why not a tax collector and a lawyer? After all, it's the expert in the law who's asking the question. Well, there's a very specific reason. Because a priest, it was in his job description to take care of the needy. And a Levite was responsible for the distribution of alms, of resources to the poor. These two other characters in the story, they had a duty to respond. And yet they passed the man by. What does Jesus want us to learn from that? That duty will never be enough. Duty will never be enough to get us to respond to the mandate of mercy and live into its mission. Because duty will always just ask us for the bare minimum. Duty will call us to do whatever it takes for us not to feel guilty. Duty will give in to fear. Duty will also result in bitterness or self-righteousness. Because duty yields distilled benevolence, while mercy pours out extravagant sacrificial love. The Samaritan risked everything for his enemy: his safety, his schedule, his money, his reputation. And he became bloody and dirty in the process, and that's the next thing. The ministry of mercy, it's messy. I mean, think about it, right? He's on this dirt, treacherous dirt road when he comes upon a naked body who's laying on the treacherous dirt road in his own blood and sweat with no clothes on him. It says he picked him up and put him on the beast. Okay, to pick him up and put him on his own animal means that now he is covered in the man's blood, sweat, and mud. And imagine, when he walks into the inn, we don't know if the inn is owned by Samaritans, we don't know if the inn is owned by Jews. When he walks into the inn, if it's owned by Jews, and here comes a Samaritan with a half-dead man who's bleeding and naked, and he is now covered in the man's blood, what are they going to think? You did this. He's immediately going to be under suspicion. If the Samaritans own the inn, and he walks in with a Jew covered in his blood and says, I need to stay here and take care of him, they're going to say, you're a betrayer. Right? It was messy. It was dirty. Galatians 6:2 says, bear one another's burdens, and in this way you fulfill the law of Christ. Bearing one another's burdens is messy, and it also means we're going to be burdened. You know, a lot of times we want to help without being burdened. Are we willing to be burdened? Because that's what it takes to respond to the mandate of mercy and live into its mission. There are times in my life that I feel like I've paid a hefty price for the people that God has put in my path. I have felt the burden. And by the end, it feels like my blood is mingled with theirs. But it's not just a burden. It's also the place that miracles happen. It's also the place that redemption happens. It's also the place that joy is birthed and meaning takes root. Because that's what the ministry of mercy accomplishes. Bearing the burden, however, is not meant to be done alone, right? And Jesus includes this in the story. Look at verse 35. And the next day he took out 2 denarii and gave them to the innkeeper, saying, take care of him, and whatever you spend, I will repay you when I come back. It was a partnership between the Samaritan and the innkeeper. Right? This journey of following Jesus, it is just never a solo journey. We do it with one another. We do it with what we call the body of Christ. We do it with the church. We do it together because you have different gifts than I do. And I have different gifts than you do. And when we all offer them, then we can rescue the bloody, broken people that God has put in our path. And that's what the Samaritan did. He took the lead. But then he engaged a partner in the ministry. There's a beautiful story of a family in our church. I've asked their permission to tell their story anonymously, but they found themselves bloody and broken and half dead on the road of life. And the wife called her care group and said, we need help. And the care group immediately responded and went over, and when some of the people from their care group got there, they realized there were some elements of what they were dealing with that they needed some help too. And so they called me, because I'm a marriage family therapist by training. And so I went over. And together, in partnership, the Lord allowed us to minister to this family. I managed the crisis for the first couple weeks, got resources in line, set out a plan. And this care group, they just loved these people faithfully and kept binding up their wounds, took care of them over the long haul. And if you could hear the story, what you would hear out of their mouth is, our church saved our lives. That's the partnership that we get to have in the ministry of mercy. It means that together we meet the needs of the people around us, whether they're believers, whether they're friends, whether they're enemies, whether they're acquaintances, that we together sacrifice, forgive, enter the mess, step into the sewer, find a way to enact some rescue. My friends, we are meant to prioritize mercy as an organizing element of our lives. We're meant to prioritize mercy as an organizing element of our lives. It's a mandate, and it's an undeniable mark of a follower of Jesus. It's all through the Bible. It's in the book of James. It's in the book of Isaiah. It's in the book of Proverbs. In the book of 1 John, it says, if you see your brother in need and you close your heart to him, then how can the love of God live in you? In Matthew 25, Jesus tells this very provocative story about the sheep and the goats, about the people who enter the kingdom and the people who don't, and the deciding factor is how they responded to the least of these. Jesus takes meeting the needs of people around us very seriously. He places a high value on it, enough that it should give us pause to reevaluate how we live. But in case you're feeling guilty, in case you're feeling overwhelmed or inadequate, that's not Jesus' point. Guilt will never take us where Jesus wants us to go. Duty will never take us where Jesus wants us to go. Obligation will not lead us into a life of freedom and rescue and joy and ministry in other people's lives. We're going to need something much more weighty, much more eternal, to motivate us to live into the mission of mercy. So what is that? Okay, remember, Jesus is on his way to the cross. The most incredible mission of mercy ever. And he's telling this story because he's answering two questions. How does one inherit eternal life? And who do I have to love? So the third thing that I see in this story is that Jesus is saying, you can't love like this until you've been loved like this. You can't rescue until you've been rescued. You can't offer mercy until you yourself have been flooded and saved by mercy. Remember the second part of the law that the lawyer stated, love your neighbor as you love yourself? That doesn't love yourself. That doesn't mean like pop psychology, talk yourself up every day, tell yourself that you're awesome, self-love. I'm not saying there's not a place for that. I'm saying that's not what this commandment's talking about. This commandment is saying, until you know yourself to be deeply loved, you will never be able to love deeply. Until you know your truest identity to be someone who's been saved by mercy, you will never be able to rescue someone else in mercy. 1 John 4 says we love because he first loved us. And that's part of the lesson of the Good Samaritan. Till we know ourselves to be the people in need, we won't be able to effectively deal with the cost, the mess, and the requirements of the mandate of mercy. Look at the end of this passage. Look at verse 36. Which of these three do you think proved to be a neighbor to the man who fell among the robbers? Do you notice what Jesus did there? He changed the man's question. Because if you ask the wrong question, you'll never get the right answer. He changed the man's question. He changed it from, who do I have to love, into who was the one who had love. He changed it from, who do I have to love, to who was it that loved you? Who was it that loved you? The question began, remember, about the minimum requirements of the law. And Jesus knows the law is the way of life, but it is not the way to life. Because the only way to life is through the mercy of God. Jesus is once again showing them their need. He's trying to help them see that they're the ones lying on the road in the story, that they were in no position to decide who to love and who not to love, that they were in desperate need of mercy themselves. And so the question was, who did the loving? That's who a neighbor is. He was showing them you can't do this in any real sustaining way until you've been loved this way. Because mercy only replaces selfishness and judgment when you've been rescued by it. We're all on the road, the perilous road of self-justification. The further I walked on that road, the more dangerous it became. Until finally the thief overcame me, robbed me, beat me with condemnation and fear, and left me broken and bruised and hopeless. Until Jesus came. And while I was still his enemy, he picked me up, covering himself in my sin and my mess, and wrapping me in his spotless robe, covering my shame. He sacrificed everything to rescue me, including his very life, and he made provision for me to live until he returns. You see, my friends, that's the story of the Good Samaritan. And until we know ourselves to be loved that deeply, we will not be able to love that deeply. So what about you? Have you known yourself to be that bloody, broken, wounded person on the road of life? Do you know that your deepest identity is that you really are loved that much? That Jesus gave up everything to rescue you, to pour out his mercy on you? You see, that's the message of the Good Samaritan. It isn't about us being good. It's about us being rescued and transformed by the mercy that rescued us. So that now, I'm so compelled by what Jesus has done for me that I would not consider withholding that mercy from someone else's life. That I would not consider passing by on the other side of the road. The mandate and mission of mercy is about responding to the needs that come into our own yards. And our motivation is gratitude. Gratitude for what we've been saved from. And our encouragement, our hope for bearing the burden, is that we know that Jesus will return and he will repay us for all we spent. Do you remember how the story ends? The Samaritan says to the innkeeper, here's what you need for now, and whatever else you spend, when I return, I will repay you. My friends, Jesus is coming back. Let's spend our lives living out the mission of mercy. Because whatever we spend, whatever burden we bear, whatever mess we enter, He will repay us. And we will bring honor and glory to the one who got our blood and sin and mess all over him to save us. For Jesus' mercy is the mission. Mercy was the mandate of his life and his death. And if we've been saved by that mercy, then we have no other choice but to go and do likewise.